Welcome to All Systems Nominal. I'm Andrew Dahl, and a technologist and game designer.
And I'm Dougal Cochrane. I'm also a game designer and TTRPG module writer.
All Systems Nominal is a tabletop role-playing game review podcast about science fiction TTRPGs. It's come about because I was literally looking through my feed the other day for podcasts about sci-fi TTRPGs specifically. And there's a great one for TTRPG modules in the science fiction genre, but there really wasn't any podcasts that stood out as being solely for dedicated to science fiction tabletop role-playing games. I literally posted on the social media platform of the Du Jour, which at this time is Blue Sky. That's probably going to date this podcast if it ever runs for a significant length of time. And I've had some experience doing this before. Where in a previous life, I founded another podcast by saying, hey, why isn't there a podcast dedicated to this thing I'm interested in? And somebody from the United Kingdom commented on the post, and I roped them into a podcast which has run successfully for over 10 years. So this appears to have happened again with Dougal.
Yeah, so that's... that somebody was me. Yeah, it's I very foolishly commented on that post and have been roped into this. But I have a keen interest in sci-fi tabletop role-playing games and was in full agreement that the space was very much underserved, I would say. So it's very cool to actually be able to sort of come on here and discuss this.
Yeah, so we're going to essentially be discovery creating this. This is literally Dougal and my first conversation, and he initially suggested one TTRPG, and then immediately followed up with another dozen plus a suggestion of multiple guests. With the cadence of this podcast, is probably going to be around once a month. We might do some infill, some counter programming. I've got a couple of ideas around that, but let's see if that happens. And we're going to be looking at primarily at systems rather than modules. There's already a great sci-fi TTRPG podcast out there that is focused primarily on science fiction modules that I highly recommend and we'll put in the show notes. But we're going to look at systems, because of course all systems are nominal.
Indeed they are. Indeed they are.
Today, we're looking at Death in Space, a tabletop role-playing game by Christian Plogfors and Carl Nibelis. And I really hope I've pronounced those names correctly. Dougal, correct me if I'm wrong here.
I think it's Niblaus, but yeah, Carl Niblaus.
Niblaus?
Yeah. Or Nibelius, I'm not quite sure, but yeah, something along those lines.
Do you want to take me through why you suggested this particular module? This particular system.
Yes, so in general, I would say that Death in Space is very much a sort of it's flown under the radar, and I think that's kind of slightly criminally flown under the radar because I think it's quite a good both system and setting. There's a lot of TTRPGs in the sort of sci-fi space have sort of communities built around them. I mean, the one that immediately springs to mind is Mothership, which has an enormous third-party community supporting it. Death in Space doesn't, and I do actually think that's a shame, and I'm hoping that we can highlight exactly why I think that during the course of this. The game itself, as you say, it's written by Christian Plogfors and Carl Nibelis. They're from Stock and Cartel. Stock and Cartel have sort of risen to fame in the TTRPG community because of games like Mörkborg, or Mörkborg, depending on how you pronounce it in the Swedish, and Cyborg as well. Which might be one that we could come on to looking at a later date. And they're published by the publishing house Free League, I believe. The game itself, I think, is worthy of review. It's an interesting setting in terms of where it sits in comparison to a lot of other sort of sci-fi games. It's definitely not utopian, and it's interesting in that it's almost post-apocalyptic, but in a sort of a broader space kind of sci-fi setting. There's a big focus in the game about survival, about subsistence. And there is a certain level of nihilism in it. It's quite a bleak game, as we'll probably discover. It's rules light as well. There are a lot of sci-fi games that are really heavy on crunch. And this is quite a rules light game that very much is, I think it's easier to run for people who might be a bit put off by games where a lot of the sci-fi is very, very codified. This one, it's written in very broad strokes, I thought. So I think it's, in certain ways, it is easier for a GM that it is finding their feet with sort of sci-fi games to run. That said, and I'll cover this later as well, I don't think there's a lot of support for, say, a new GM to this. But I'll talk about that later.
Before we get too deep into the text, I did want to just sort of lay out a bit of a thesis for this show. When you're looking at a close reading of a text, particularly around role-playing games or tabletop games in particular, or in fact any games, it's very easy to get into this quite critical mode. And I mean critical not in a sense of, you know, literary criticism, but in a sense of identifying the weaknesses everywhere and, pulling the text apart in a way that kind of, we spend 90% of the time talking about the problems and only 10% of times looking at the stuff that really makes you feel happy about it. It's an easy trap to fall into as a podcaster, and I'm certainly guilty of it myself. And so what I really want to focus on when we look at the, we're going to be a review style show, but, you know, there's going to be hopefully quite a bit of analysis in here as well. And so when we're looking at a particular text, I really want to be focusing on what it does well, what its strengths are, you know, and because we have to really acknowledge, you know, that all systems nominal means the systems are good in every game that we look at. And if we see a problem, it's only because we're fallible humans and the faults actually lie with ourselves rather than with the game, which is, of course, a finished and perfectly complete artifact. And, you know, so when we're diving into this game, you know, we're going to be looking at those real strengths that you've talked about. And really, having said that all, to start with, this is a very black game and my printer went owie.
Yeah, it's, when he's saying it's a very black game, he's not kidding. It's a very, as in the color or absence thereof. The actual physical appearance of the game, it's all printed on black paper.
Presumably it's white paper with an enormous quantity of ink laid on top of it to get, what is essentially, it's real black and white text, black backgrounds with use of spot color. And what's really nice is that spot color transitions throughout the text section from section. So it starts out with red and then it moves into blues, pinks, and then in the scenario, greens, and then finally in the tables at the back, yellows. Most of it is very kind of iconic graphic design. You know, not lots of strong lines.
That's actually kind of a trademark of the Stockholm Cartel guys. So a lot of their games are very, very striking in terms of graphic design. The kind of core team have all got very strong graphic design skills. I've got a hard copy of the book and the cover of it is quite striking as well. It's done with like sort of silver, foil. It's got an astronaut in a back suit, with a tether looking like they're plunging towards a sort of, a very kind of sort of, graphic that I think is meant to represent a black hole of some sort.
Yeah, any circular body, you know, falling into a planet. Yeah. It could be yeah, anything, but there is this absence of light. And that's all set up by this, you know, contrasting black and white lines. And then throughout the art itself is again quite more broken up into sort of, you know, inks.
There's a lot of it as well that resembles sort of schematics, just flicking through it as well. Whenever it's got sort of technology or ships or space stations and things like that, a lot of the design looks like it was from a blueprint or a technical manual. And I guess that is, to a certain extent, the vibe they're going for is that it's a recovered technical manual.
Yeah, but what's really lovely with those schematics is you don't realize it initially, but a number of those are maps.
Yes.
This is not only an amazing schematic, but it's actually a map. Now, is it a map you can use to navigate somewhere? That's debatable. But certainly there is this way of defining the space schematically. So you think about, okay, there's stuff that's mentioned in the map and there's stuff that's not mentioned in the map. One last thing I want to touch on the cover is that I'm going to examine every game for this, because we must, we can do whatever we want here. So we're going to start by laying some ground rules of what is this podcast looking for? And the first one of that is a skeleton in a spacesuit. And we're halfway there. We have probably a dead guy in a spacesuit, but there's no skull. So we're going to be looking for skeletons in spacesuits. The second thing we're going to be looking for, and I've joked about this elsewhere, but I'm quite, in some ways, very serious about it as well, in that every good science fiction story has to start with a meal and end on a beach. And that's just, in one sense, it's nonsense, but in another sense, it's a useful way to think about the game. And that if you're starting with, or any science fiction, if you're starting with a meal, you're looking at what are social customs? What are the material conditions that people live under? What are the foods they look at? How human or alien are they? And so you think of, the opening scene in Aliens, where they're all getting out of the cryopods and immediately straight into that mess hall and sitting there and eating and starting to build those relationships out. And so a meal is a very human thing that enables us to find the boundaries of the science and the fiction within a space that we innately understand. We innately understand the customs of eating food. And so we can see, well, that's unusual. Somebody's done that differently to what we'll look at here. And then the beach, which we'll get to at the end, the beach is this liminal space between the safety of the land and the unknowability of the ocean. There's the depths out there that are hidden and and conceal all kinds of things. And so, and then you think about movies that end on the beach. There's, of course, Planet of the Apes is probably the one that immediately sprung to mind. But also one of my favorites, The Quiet Earth, another amazing science fiction film from made in New Zealand, my home country. And so, as I said, that's another thing we'll probably look back at. And what I was delighted to see is coming into this book, we hit the meal immediately because the opening two pages are not the credits. The opening two pages are an equipment list with prices and slots, at least in the PDF.
So you're talking about the inside.
Yes, so
cover
in the PDF,
spread.
That's the opening two pages.
So in the hard copy, which I'm holding up to our camera here so that he can do it, equipment lists that you're talking about, the food, clothing, costs of services, even cost of what a pet might cost, is all listed inside the front cover spreads. So yeah, you're absolutely right. It gives you an idea of the kind of culture that you're about to be sort of dipping into. And immediately there's pieces that are jumping out at you about some of the themes of this game. The food, for example, it's all freeze dried and synthetic and rehydratable, thermostabilized. It's all very much the kind of sort of thing an astronaut might eat. It's very much processed. There's not a lot of fresh stuff here. And where it does talk about something that's fresh, you can see that the costs are higher. It's the same with a lot of the equipment, tools, and methods of survival are valuable. You can see that the costs of those are all sort of fairly high. And you can see that is obviously going to be a theme of this game, is survival and scarcity.
And of the eight services you can buy listed in this, one of them is a murder contract. Kind of immediately setting the expectation that perhaps life is cheap here.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you can see that there's a lot of stuff is all about repairing things, components, parts. So again, there's a lot of implication that there's going to be such salvage and subsistence here. There's also how much fuel costs and what events might use up fuel on here, which are things like failing fleeing rolls and failing risky maneuvers, launching from high gravity. So there's an implication that there's going to be a fair amount of risk in space.
Yep. And if we move through to the actual setting itself, there's a two-column format, which is slightly annoying to read. Nothing too critical. And the amount of text on each page is, you know, quite large font sizes, quite, you know, well-spaced out text. The first three words of the setting are a collapsing universe. And it talks about this void that is rumored and unknowable. And then it sets up something that I think, to me, didn't ring quite so true. And I've sort of had to kind of reflect on this a bit, because this void and the assertion that the universe might have stopped expanding is rejected by scientists. And that to me felt like a missed opportunity. Because frankly, if maybe that's the sort of dividing line between this game and a more Cthulhu style universe, where the scientists would of course be panicking and freaking out and denying and, you know, and worse when confronted with this perhaps existential threat. And so I was kind of trying to sit here and weigh up that sort of, well, the scientists are rejecting these things and calling them tales of nightmares. But as you see, as we move throughout the book, this void infects almost everything that in the game. And it touches the players, player characters at every point in the game.
It's pervasive, isn't it? It's very much, it lurks in the background in quite a lot of the text and in a lot of the various mechanisms of the game. So that the characters are always going to be exposed to it. And one of the things it highlights as well is that whenever you turn on any communications, there's always this background static kind of sort of murmur with strange voices in it. So it's always present. There's this feeling that something's not quite right.
Yeah, and the game explicitly says if you're going to communicate or program or alter anything, you walk up with a cable and plug in your cable to avoid that interference. But then the starting scenario requires that you reprogram something to send some wireless transmissions. So we have this notion, and this actually, I think we can solve in the second column of text, because it talks about the gem war. And the gem war, as far as I can see, is this notion of we had something that was a significant resource, and we now exist in a fallen universe where that resource is no longer available. The artifacts that we built with these gems that have half mined or harvested from a system.
Should we give a bit of context on that actually? So the setting talks about a gem war, which is essentially a corporate war over a finite resource that is used for faster than light travel, which is these gemstones, which are, I believe, only mined in one system, which is the kind of pivotal to the setting, which is the Tenebris system, I believe it's called.
Which is the system that the game recommends that you start in. It's kind of the key location.
So the idea is this war absolutely tore the galaxy apart, and it ended about a decade ago. And the game itself is almost set in the ruins of a galaxy that has been absolutely destroyed by war. But the other key issue of the war is that now it has halted manufacture, it has halted agriculture, and the method of travelling between disparate points now is so finite and so rare that it's becoming less and less common, and it's becoming the province of the rich, and people are absolutely at each other's throats over these finite resources. But also what people are living in now is essentially the wreckage of this war. That literally everyone is subsisting in wrecks and shanty towns and orbital stations that have been cobbled together from the wreckage of that war. So again, quite a bleak nihilistic setting to a certain extent, but I think that's part of the unique appeal, I think.
To step back a little bit and go back to this, you know, we're defining what this podcast is in real time, coasting into the future. Science fiction and the idea of science fiction as a genre doesn't sit cleanly with games. And what I mean by that is the mode that games best play in is actually science fantasy rather than science fiction. It doesn't have the rigor of science fiction, and I'll try and talk about that a little bit more. Because the science part of science fiction is this imposition of rules. It's this imposition of, well, we could write anything, but we're going to artificially impose these constraints on ourselves to write of a world that is somehow related to ours and has the strict conditions placed on our world. But maybe we tweak one factor. We change one part so that to allow faster light travel or to allow this. And what are the implications of that? Experiment in varying the conditions and then elaborating out from that. And so that, I think, is a real challenge that anyone writing in the science fiction mode has to engage with, because games don't do that well. People don't want to have those constraints put on them when they role play. They want to be able to invent things whole cloth without feeling like that they've somehow broken the rules of the game. And so science fiction's always, games are always at this tension. I think that's partly why fantasy games are generally better or generally more popular is probably a better way of putting things. But in the other sense, fantasy games aren't pure because they're governed by rules. And that's the science part of a fantasy game, is the fact that your magic has to have rules applied to it and mechanics. And it can't just be a pure escapist fantasy. And so Death in Space is definitely on the science fantasy edge of science fiction. It's got, as we talk about, you know, moving into the game, the Void in particular is the most fantastical part of this game. It's still definitely science fiction, but I definitely want to, through this podcast, explore this idea of how far do you go in either direction? How much is fantasy? How much is science? What are the tensions there?
It's definitely a tension in that whole science fiction versus science fantasy debate. And I do think as well that is part of the appeal to a certain extent of fantasy games. I think fantasy games are in some ways easier to run than science fiction games, because I think science fiction, some of the time, it's asking for you to have almost a scaffold of explanation for some of the effects that you have. I think sometimes fantasy games can be a little bit more hand wavy in terms of, you do have a logic to your magic, but it is quite easy to say, I mean, I'm being very, very generalist here, but and very facetious to a certain extent, but a wizard did it. In science fiction, to a certain extent, you're trying to extrapolate things that we know. And I think sometimes players find that, and both players and the GMs that run these games find that they are trying to explain things in a crunchier and more detailed way than they might otherwise do in a fantasy game. When you have situations where things are being hacked, for example, or repaired or salvaged or jury-rigged, sometimes there is a less of an inclination to be as hand wavy, and that you are asking people to have sort of specific tools. You're asking people to have specific equipment. You're asking people to have specific resources. Whereas in a fantasy game, quite often the only requirement you're saying is that you can do magic.
And definitely this is a game that cares deeply about those resources. We've already looked at the price list. You know, it's got value of the currency is hollows. It's got value of in hollows of everything, down to, you know, the one hollow. And so I can easily see here you're going to have a sheet that is nothing but you crossing out the number of hollows you currently have, or tracking it using dice or some other kind of mechanic in there that it wants you to feel like you're caring about that. But, you know, as we get to it, yeah. In fact, on the next page, It talks about Hollows may be what you want to pay for your daily dose of moonshine, but the real currency is something else. It's this notion of contracts.
The setting is very much implying that there's a sort of a barter system of labor, and that is the kind of sort of true value. And again, that's a pretty believable with the premise of the subsistence setting.
The actual value is probably not in the contracts themselves. It's in the ability to get more contracts. And therefore implying that relationships are important, implying that, you know, we have fallen, but what's holding us together is the people we know.
The other valued currency, I would say there's a third strand to it, which is because of the degrading nature of everything you have in the game. The other valuable strand, I would say, is components and being able to repair the things that you have. Because as you find out later in the system, a lot of the things you have will wear out and break, and you really want to be able to maintain them. So that's less about actual cash, and it's all more about what you need to actually fix things.
And then on page 7, we come across this first schematic that's actually a map, which is Inaru, which is the moon, which the gems were mined on, and the wreckage and rubble floating around it. And then we move on to the conversation about the iron ring, which is essentially a ring-like structure of thousands of old spacecraft refinery modules surrounding this moon.
Yeah, if you can imagine like one of the rings of Saturn, but imagine that had coalesced out of the wreckage of an intergalactic war, that's pretty much what the iron ring is. And then imagine all that welded and duct taped together into one ring-shaped orbital space station that is thousands and thousands of miles long, surrounding this planetary body. It's a pretty good, an interesting take on a setting, and it does give you quite a lot to work with as a GM, I would say. I've run the adventure that comes with this, which is set in that setting, and I do think that there's quite a lot of scope in it as to what you could add to it. I mean, it's an enormous space that you could put in whatever factions that you want, and it has some examples. But the other, it also talks about areas of it being long abandoned. So that's again, that's slightly sort of almost science fantasy conceit. And essentially it's got a floating dungeon for you to explore because there's empty sections of it.
Yeah. And I could easily see a campaign entirely set on the Iron Ring with no movement off of it. Okay. Let's move on to characters. And there's only 4 abilities here. I think there's a good number. I think 6 these days is always a bit too much, and it's a straight modifier-based system. So roll 2d4, the second d4 subtracted from the first d4 gives you ability, and that's a modifier to your d20 roll.
So the system is essentially a d20, and you're trying to get a 12 or higher to succeed, and you're adding the relevant statistic to that. And they range between -3 up to +3. So it's not a huge range either. The ability scores, some folk who have played other Stockholm Cartel games will recognize they're very similar to games like Merc, Borg, and they're very similar to Cyborg. But in this game, it's body, dexterity, savvy, and tech, as opposed to your usual sort of kind of strength, dexterity, I think it's presence and toughness that the other ones tend to use.
What's interesting about this from a mechanical point of view is that because your target number is always 12, there's almost always performing an action. Even in the best circumstances, you rarely have a good chance at getting that target number of 12 when you're rolling a d20 and adding. It's only if you have a +3 that you've got a better than 50% chance of succeeding. So it's a very, very slight success, but it does have an advantage and disadvantage system. And getting an advantage statistically is around +3 1/3 modifier. So if you think about it, what you really want to be doing is putting yourself into positions where you have advantages on every action. And that's as good, if not better, than having the best possible ability in the game. And so the way of thinking about that, and we'll get to the other mechanics around that a little bit later, but the way of thinking here is very much about how am I going to get the advantage in every situation? What am I going to do? How am I going to describe my actions and so on?
Now, that's very much how the game plays out when you're running it. is that it becomes a dialogue between you and the players, where the player is trying to work out ways that they can get an advantage on the role. So either through tools or through taking time or through multiple people working on the same problem and assisting each other. They're trying to gain advantage on these rules to sort of maximize their chance of success. It's a very much the kind of approach of what's known as a sort of OSR style strand of gaming. So old school Renaissance. So it's very much that kind of sort of, most of those games in that bracket use that kind of sort of idea of tools, training and time are the three things that will either improve your chances on a dice roll or negate the need for a dice roll altogether. And that's kind of what this is. That's the kind of sort of, root of the philosophy behind this game, I would say.
Yeah. And then we move on to character origins. And this is the first page where I went, this game's got the juice. There are six origins. They are summarized in a single A4 page.
It's A5.
The origins are Carbon, Chrome, Punk, Soul Pod, Velocity Cursed, and Void. And I think if you wanted to divide your science fiction scenario into six divisions and ways of thinking about it, I don't think you could pick a better set of six than these. I really love the origins. I think they're amazingly well done. They are literally four or five lines of text, maybe five words to a line, two abilities of which you choose one, and the names are great. What they are is great. A carbon, it's probably a clone, somebody grown in an artificial womb. A punk is the original old school humans. Chromes are AI in organic matter. And then the three that are really good, soul pods.
Soul pod is my favorite because essentially they come across as space vampires. It doesn't have anything about vampirism, but it's people who are essentially hibernating for decades, staying awake for short periods of time, and they have a sort of a cryo support system that they carry about. It is fueled by starlight, which is very poetic, I thought. And it regenerates them. But
the implication is in their name is that they're all from Earth, because Sol is the name of the Earth system. It doesn't appear anywhere else in the scenario, but that three letters in that word immediately implies his whole history of having lived long enough in time in the distant past. There's no years listed anywhere in this, that the Sol pods are originally from Earth and have survived since then. Velocity cursed. Well, I was going to say soul pods are time travelers forwards. Velocity cursed are time travelers back. You could call them time shifted.
Velocity cursed is the first of the origins that is starting to speak to some of the weirder aspects of this setting. We very briefly touched on the void and of sort of, the universe collapsing in on itself. And these, of the six origins, these are one of the two that I think are very much sort of tied to that. So Velocity Curse, the idea is that they've lost part of their connection to reality and they kind of shift and out of space time. What that means is that they, because they're detached from space time, they can remember forwards, and occasionally can get sort of, directions from the games master running the game, and he will hint about where they should be going, because they're remembering forward, which I think is a really clever system. They also have, what was the other ability they gave them? A pocket world, starting with a portable sort of virtual reality server where you store your memories because you're so detached, you need to store them externally, but you can allow other people to connect to this little portable world that you've got and view your memories. Very cool.
And then finally, the Void themselves, who are clearly touched by this substance, presence, damage.
In some sort of entropic force. It's very, very general about it. It lets you kind of fill in the blanks yourself, which I quite like. And essentially, it's sort of creepy shamans and priests that are touching on this strangeness.
They have the two weakest abilities. One of them is literally you can make electronics nearby emit static noise, and that's it. The possibilities, of course, with that are endless. It's a D6 table, and I think D6 tables are the best tables. Simply a range of six values, I think, really forces you to define enough stuff that you have to start going into these weird edge cases like the Velocity Curse and the Void have, without it becoming, and some of the other tables in the section, a bit more.
Let me just, one of the things I'll tell you from experiences of running it is that one thing that is really good about this kind of system is it's very quick for you to get up and running with a player. There's none of this sort of having to write an extensive background and justify it all with a ranges of skills that you buy with points or anything like that. You are simply making a series of dice rolls that the player interprets that are colouring in broad strokes a character that they can get cracking with immediately. And that is also feeding them a lot of the setting sort of diegetically about, what the setting is about, themes of the setting. That's all bleeding through in these tables, which is really, really helpful. I think it's doing the world building as you make your character and teaching you about the setting.
And the background table is great. It's got two words squished together, which I think is the best way to do science fiction, is literally take two words and squish them together and figure out what that means. And the background table does that for you. You know, what is a moon outlaw? Immediately confronts you with that idea.
Gravity Swindler was my favorite. How do you swindle people out of gravity?
and that's wonderful. I'm less enamored of some of these other tables. I think they are a bit too generic. They lack some of the specificity that you're forced into by this kind of two-word combination.
Generally, I found people just sort of flavored the way they were speaking out of the trait and drive tables for the most part. The drive table actually is reasonably useful. Some of them do push sort of that kind of sort of emergent kind of role playing. If you've got someone who always has to be right, or if you've got someone who doesn't like to be alone, it does drive certain situations. It works quite well.
Okay. That's good to know. The looks table, again, it's not, it's a clothing table, which is fine, but it doesn't really speak to the person underneath. And I think that's always going to be a bit hard because the six origins are so different. You almost kind of want a looks table for each of them. So I can kind of see it's some flavor in there, but then we get to another great table and we've had origins, we've had background, a lot of speaking to this fallen past. And then we have the past allegiance, which is literally what happened to you during the Gem War. Were you on the winning side? Were you on the losing side? What did you do? Did you keep your head down? And that's, again, a really great way of thinking about that.
It's very good in terms of you being able to, your characters to be able to immediately relate to the people that you meet, because all of them tend to have an allegiance as well. And you either have common ground or you have a point of conflict. But either way, it promotes some good role playing, and it can promote opportunities, or it can create obstacles. But I found it was a very, very useful little tidbit about each character.
You see, I think you could almost cut these down to three tables, which would be that past allegiance, the origin, and the starting kit, which is the third one. It's essentially what kind of class you are in the more classic sense of a prospector, a mercenary, or so on. And that, I think, rounds out the character generation. There's some personal trinkets, which I always like. I think the trinkets table I really enjoy. That's much more good for defining a person. But I guess I'm more sort of a play to find out approach. And so I guess you're depending on the kind of person you are, it might be, you might need that. You want to do the accent. You want to do the argument. You want to collide some ideas together and figure out a background based on that. And then notably, what it doesn't do, but it kind of does do, is the challenge you have in any game, which is how do the characters come together? And it does so in a really clever way, I think, which is you're all on the same hub. And the hub could be a spacecraft, or it could be a station. And it doesn't tell you why.
So a point I wrote in my notes was that the hub very much feels like a communal extra character that the players all collaborate to build. And yes, as you say, it's either a space station or it's some sort of bit of wreckage you're inhabiting, or it's an actual spaceship that can move about. And the players all input into that and customizing it. And one of the drives and the like core kind of almost loops of gameplay in the game is that you're trying to keep your hub going. And it's very much, this was one of the things I thought was quite good, that the themes of the game bleed through right through to the sort of systems of the game, which bleed through to what you have and what you are controlling, which is your player characters, but also your hub. And it's very much exemplifying that you need to scrabble to find resources, keep things repaired and keep things going. And it's really drawing on a lot of like sort of themes that you might see in, like TV shows like Firefly, where it's like they want to sort of do the job, get paid, keep flying. You know,
why does this TV show have such an impact on this medium? I've never seen Firefly. I've only heard it's got bad politics, and I don't understand why.
It's very much about the sort of north and south, and it very much sort of US based. But the bit they did have that I do think this is probably exemplifying is that kind of sort of very blue collar, trying to do jobs to subsist, and you're not really hoping to sort of do much more than, you're not going to strike it rich in this game particularly, or be sort of super wealthy. It just isn't that sort of setting. Whatever you've got is either going to make you a target at best if you do make a reasonable amount of well.
To me, this game felt, if I was going to pick a science fiction scenario, to me, this game really felt like Revelation Space by Alistair Reynolds. And that kind of, I don't know if you've read any of those books, that kind of has this, it has a ruined series of habitats floating around a planet. It has kind of characters who look like the characters they have drawn in that character section, the character art. There's just a set of two pages with, I think, four or five figures on them. Revelation Space is a lot more hard sci-fi. It's relativistic travel, because you can do that kind of stuff as an author. You can play those kind of tricks across multiple timelines and so on. But it had the same kind of feel of not just there are ancient civilizations, but those ancient civilizations are still around and they're still deadly, and you really don't want to attract their attention.
Yeah, it reminded me a lot of James S. A. Corey's stuff as well, the Expanse series, the kind of culture of the Belter types, and again, how he presents precursor kind of sort of civilizations of aliens, again, has that slightly sort of, I think alien is the word, isn't it? But very, very, very much out with the human experience. And not something to sort of be messed with lightly. That very much comes through in this game. But I think we're veering off the hub part though, and just sort of bringing it back to that. Again, there's some tables in that section that are really good at telling the story of the setting. So the hub has its own background tables about where it was from, where it was salvaged from, what it was originally before you repurposed it, that kind of thing. And it gives it a little sort of history that I find really good, because it makes it's that same appeal that when I first saw Star Wars for the first time, that world felt lived in, because everything looked grubby and had like sort of burns on it and marks on it and scarring on it. And I feel like the player's hub through these tables is getting that as well. It's getting its battle scars. It's getting its damage. It's getting its, you know, it's been previously infested with something, or it's, you know, it was the site of a, like an infamous, you know, massacre or something. There's all sort of weird stuff in the table.
Particularly for science fiction, which is not rooted in the real world or in the kind of tropey fantasy world we maybe thought of that is sort of Tolkien-esque world that we're probably more familiar with as a setting than almost anything else, is that the table gives you the range of possibilities. It's permissive and restrictive in the sense that you can see, you can go and invent anything in this range. And these tables are great because they give you a very, very big range straight away to say, you're allowed to do this thing in the setting. Item one on the station table, touched by the void, arrived from the future after failed bridging jump. Straight away, you are allowed to do any time travel shenanigans you want within the setting. You know that now. You can break, if you weren't, you know, reading the velocity challenge, I'm going to get this wrong every time.
Velocity curse. Yeah. You got it.
If you weren't reading them already, but you are now, you know, straight away, that you can take any mothership timey-wimey module, whack it straight into the setting and give it, you know, its own dark flavor. These tables are great for that because they're permitting you to do a whole lot of things. They're saying this is allowed and they're saying, you know, what is the probable things that happen? It's all within these tables. And you don't even have to read the starting scenario to know what you can do here and to get ideas, you know, because if you only get to roll once on this table, but the game moderator gets to roll as many times as they want.
And as well as that, the player is just getting to read these things and read through these tables and absorb them. And it's teaching you about the setting as you go. And it's telling you about the possibilities of the setting as you go. You know what you can now expect in a space station. You know what you can expect in terms of the different ships of the game, what they might be used for. So it's doing all that world building in a really, really clever way. And in quite a sort of a condensed way. I do really like random tables just as a way of teaching, you know, the context of the culture, the technology and everything else for a game. It works really, really well.
Yeah. And moving on to the systems and actual systems of play, we've already talked about ability checks. There's inventory management in here, something few games get right, and this is another addition on a slot-based system. I don't think there's too much to comment on here. But you mentioned OSR earlier, and there is the most OSR ass table in here, which is the reactions table. I believe that's straight out of original D&D, pre Moldov set D&D. And that was the point I went, oh, okay, this is OSR. This is, to me, positioning what this game is all about. You know, the mechanics, use of advantage and disadvantage, a classic reaction table. And then we move on to the second part of the game that I went, okay, this is amazing. Somebody's done a really good job here. And that's void points. And you're going to have to tell me if this system exists in any other game. I probably haven't read it, and I'm sure this is cribbed from somewhere, because if it's not, it's an absolutely genius piece of design.
So let's kind of sort of give a high level view of it. What we're talking about here is a lot of games have like a sort of I think the term is used as meta currency, where you can spend a point to get a reroll or something like that. And quite often these games award them for you doing something cool, or you get a finite amount every day or something like that. You get them for resting. Death in Space doesn't do that. You don't start with these points. It doesn't award them to you. And the Games Master doesn't award them. He's not involved in the process. If you fail an ability check, you gain a void point. And the most void points you can have any time is 4. And you can use a void point to get advantage on a dice roll. So like an ability check or an attack roll. Or you can use it to activate what are called cosmic mutations. I'll come to those in a minute. So essentially, it's re-rolls, it's ways to abrogate failure. It's essentially letting you roll twice and take the best result. However, you also have these things called cosmic mutations. You can get those as a starting character just through some of the random tables. I think the void character often starts with them. You can often pick them up from some of the creatures in the game as well. I think there's one of them that does that to you. Or you can pick them up by actually spending experience points. And cosmic mutations allow you to basically do sort of slightly more fantastical abilities.
In many senses, they're psychic powers, but there are other cool abilities related to them.
However, there is a cost to using these things. It's not free. So if you try and use them, and if you spend a void point to gain advantage, for example, and you still fail, you get what's called void corruption. And you can pick up these sort of void corruption effects, which start to erode who you are, or they start to give you very strange sort of weaknesses, or they mutate you in very odd ways. Some of them are pretty debilitating, quite frankly. And some of them can make you absolutely look like an absolute freak. So it really can change you if you channel the void. So unlike a lot of games, there is a risk to trying to improve your dice rolls using the meta currency. And as I say, it's not awarded for you being cool or doing heroic things or anything like that. It's rewarded through failure, which is quite unique, I think.
There's a couple of things I want to talk about that's really interesting about these. And the first one is that you can't spend them if you've already got advantage. Because if you've already got advantage, you can't spend a void point to get that advantage. So if you are being careful, you just keep accumulating void points. If you're playing by the rule, the way the rules you want you to proceed and how you want to do the game, which is very carefully using advantage in every situation you possibly can get it, then you start building up these void points. And void corruption, the check for void corruption is roll 1d6 less than or equal to the number of void points you have. And so if you accumulate the void points by playing the game carefully, you end up making things worse for you whenever you fail a roll where you would be spending your void points. So it's a negative feedback loop. And there's this wonderful negative feedback loop that easily, and it's an in-game economy as well, because, you know, we talked about this. We haven't gone into detail about repairs, and I think based on the time of the recording, we probably won't go into repairs too much other to say there's an extensive repair system. But this economy of void points, where you've got to spend them, you can't hang on to them because they make things worse for you. So you've got to spend them, and you've got to spend them in situations you're being a bit more rash or careless. And I think it's just great. I think it's so simple and so wonderfully done that as soon as you start thinking about the implications of it, and you go, oh, hang on, it's just so smart. So utterly cleverly put together.
And the actual mutations are very, very, very sci-fi, if you see what I mean. There's a lot of them that aren't, there's some that are more that science fantasy kind of vibe to them, but there's other ones where, you're being able to communicate with electronics, or you're magnetic, or there's various sort of mutations where you're like picking up like dual hearts or whatever. The void corruption ones, if you failed some roles and picked up void corruptions, where you become more sensitive to pain, or you literally become sort of surrounded by darkness, or you emit like computer viruses and things, so you become very, very entropic. So it's very much sort of playing with that theme of entropy, these things. But yeah, it's very, very on theme and reinforcing the themes of the game.
Funny to me how much science fiction and horror get tied together. Almost every science fiction game is going to end up potentially feeling like a horror game. You know, it's something that Mothership naturally goes towards. And to a large part, it's because there are so many successful science fiction movies that are almost horror movies.
I mean, let's be honest. Let's blame Alien here. I mean, really. Yeah,
the foundational deck.
It's such an influence on a lot of these games. But,
it's odd to me because if you think about fantasy for more than a minute, every fantasy game should be far, far more terrifying than it is. They put Charm Person as a first level spell. Charm Person. Mind control is a first level spell. In D&D.
Just the premise of most D&D games, which is going into a dark hole in the ground with nothing but a torch and a sharp object, trying to fight horrible monsters. it's not a fun time.
More people should be doing, Ursula K. Le Guin style, that's the dark place, you just don't go there. Kind of vibes in fantasy. And so to me, I think you're right. There's not enough horror fantasy. And whereas in science fiction, it's a foundational text. Whereas, you know, again, if you, to me, horror is, you know, fantasy has so much more potential for horror, but in reality, we don't explore it nearly as much.
That said, I will say that you don't have to run Death in Space as a horror game. And indeed, the starting adventure is not a horror scenario in any way, shape or form. It is more, I would say, sort of social conflict and organized crime. I think it's probably about the best way I could describe it. There was one other part of the system that I wanted to talk about, and that was combat. And the reason I wanted to talk about that was because there's another aspect to this game that I think is a bit unique in comparison to a lot of other games, and that is the initiative system. So the initiative system in Death in Space, I think, is pretty unique. There's a lot of OSR games is usually our side goes, your side goes, or a lot of other role-playing games, it's just everyone is rolling to see who is going next in an order, which you then stick to, a sort of a hierarchy of action. That is not what Death in Space does. Death in Space, once you essentially made your check to see who goes first in a combat, the next person to act is nominated by the person acting, which leads to a very, very interesting dynamic in combat. And again, I think it reinforces the theme of the game, which is generally you're sort of working together to survive. You're working together to support your hub. In a fight, your players are working together to support one another because they are choosing who acts next. The key bit to be careful of, though, is that once everyone has acted, the last person to act in a round chooses who begins the next round, and they can choose themselves. So if you all go first and leave your opponent to go last, your opponent may very well act twice, as an example. Initiative becomes a conversation. It's not like just random dice rolls. It becomes quite an interesting conversation during the course of a combat. And it does make for some interesting scenarios, whereas fights are very, rather than sort of I go, you go. There's actually a sort of an interesting conversation at the table. And I found that really, really good. I've never come across anything like that before in a game where there's been that sort of conversation. And I felt it merited mentioning.
That to me felt very innovative as well. And I think we'll talk a little bit about space travel as we move into the setting scenario, because they do have a section on fuel use and space travel. But there is this great map of the system. I think pretty much every science fiction game I've encountered has to have way too fast travel compared to what is physically possible using even projected future technologies. This is another one of them. Travel times to the, you know, outer rim of a system are in weeks. They should be in years. The jump system allows you to jump between galaxies. I think that kind of underrates how big a galaxy is. Our galaxy is so enormously big that you could contain everything in it everything you could possibly conceive of in such a tiny little fraction of the overall galaxy. It's almost impossible to describe how big our galaxy is. And yet you want the players to travel to another one. That to me always feels overkill.
That's where we're getting into our fantasy again, which is what this gem conceit is for, really, is so that you can hand wave that.
You're not going to do that. You're going to do much more of a travel along the lines of what they have in the setting, which is a single system. And then they have if you want to call it, it's not quite a sector map, but it's a path through a set of star systems with these buoys, signal points. I can't remember what the technology calls it, essentially.
The navvies, they call them, where they've got these very lonely people living out in deep space at the jump points, maintaining the jump points. That sounds like a great time. Especially in this setting with the encroaching void.
Yeah, it's not excluding your ability to travel to other stars, but there's definitely preferred paths through these systems. And what's quite nice about the Tenebris system is something I've always hated in the Eclipse phase, and perhaps is also problematic in a number of other systems, which is You got a star system and you can just put a little bit of every single science fiction book you've ever read into it. In some corner, there's, you know, the robots, and another corner, there's the aliens, another corner, there's the cloud city, and all these kind of cliches just get spread out across a single system. And yeah, we get it. Star systems are big. Even a planet is way bigger than you can possibly conceive of. But this Tenebris system is very specific in terms of what's contained inside it. It's not trying to be all things to all people. It has a little bit of the jungle planet and the ice planet vibes going to it, which, you know, in itself is another, a bit tropey. But it does have some quite interesting places to go to. It's quite clear about what those places are and what they do.
I think what I appreciated yep. about a lot of the locations was that they're very much oriented towards material for the GM in the context of jobs and work, which again is the core aspect of this game, is players trying to do jobs and survive. For the most part, I would say, I might say 90% of them have an industrial kind of vibe to them. And what it picks out as the sort of unique features is generally what's being done there in terms of, say, mining or refining or anything like that.
Other than the Iron Ring, there's no kind of mega structures or particularly, there's no world city or anything like that that kind of would be mistaken for a high-tech location. There's a place called The Block, which is a 36-hectare square with tens of thousands of people in it. I did the maths. That's roughly the population density of Manila. So it's not, that's not particularly science fiction. That's just, you know, a crowded city. It's, you know, Manila's probably the most densely populated major city in the world, but it's not, you know, it's not science fiction crammed together. There's a broken planet, Lead, which has been hit by a massive meteor and remains shattered. I looked at this not so long ago. If you blow up the moon, it's going to reform into the moon in about 2 weeks. It doesn't actually stay blown up for very long because gravity just swoops it all back together.
The gravity just crushes it back into a ball shape. Yeah.
You have to really blow up the moon.
I guess it's also supposed depends on what it's actually yep. made of, and maybe it's made of some particular yep. mineral that's not inclined yep. to.
Yeah, I know.
That said, it's a cool thing to go yep. and look at. Yep. So yeah, I'm willing yeah. to forget
so this,
it
you know, we can again, we're not too worried about the physics here.
I'm also appreciative that it isn't just planets. That it talks about space docks. It talks about, if you look at the sort of the main map of the system, it's talking about, it's got like sort of ice fields and things like that. So there's an ice cloud that is essentially the outer kind of sort of ring of debris around the system is that. It's got Inuro and the Iron Ring, obviously, but there's like a variety of sort of moons and asteroid belts and things like that for you to go explore as well. So that's all kind of sort of good kind of deep veins of material for a games master to be able to sort of colour in their own details. I appreciate games that give you enough to riff off as a games master. You know, enough detail that you've got something to work with, but enough painted in broad strokes or left uncertain that you can fill in some blanks yourself and be creative. I think this walks that line
yeah.
reasonably
and
well.
It makes it again quite clear the kind of people you're dealing with, because the organizations it mentions in conjunction with the system are called cults, and they're cults. They're all weird, wonderful groups of individuals.
Well, weird, yep. weird is the term, yes. Yeah, there's more probably exemplified, I would say, in the adventure in terms yep. of culture, as well as the cults. But yeah, the cults themselves do bear mentioning. They are very, very strange. They ones that there is are essentially trying to sort of mold matter with their minds and things like that. I did quite like the that some of them also drive play to a certain extent. There's one that's all about exploration. I quite liked as well that the system it uses for exemplifying the cult. So it talks about how they dress, what they believe, what they want, who runs them, what they need. And I thought that was very clever. that because there are going to be, the players are going to be trying to trade in commodities and things like that, each of the cults, it lists their scarcities and also what they have, what they can trade. And then it gives you some keywords, which are probably things that you could keep dropping in descriptions of them, that you could keep using in both in like your visual descriptions, but it's also got like sort of your communications with them. So quite a lot of the keywords I notice in some of these things are sounds. So one of them is very much associated with shadows and whispers. Another one is hissing. Another one is static. You know, so there's different sort of ways that there's a different vibe, a different impression that every single cult is going to give on your players, and it's going to be different every time. And I think having these keywords picked out for you is a really clever mechanism for doing that. It's really helpful for somebody running the game, because it's a really quick way for you to just pick up a few words, start dropping them into your descriptions.
Well, talk me through the adventure. You've run it. I've read it. It's quite clear, I think. It's well written.
The adventure is meant to introduce you to the Iron Ring. Essentially, the premise of it is that it's a power struggle between a couple of factions on the Iron Ring. And the issue is that if this struggle isn't resolved within a certain time scale, then a very, shall we say, brutal ringleader will arrive with a violent thugs, and there'll be quite a sort of a deadly kind of conflict as this this issue is essentially resolved. The struggle is over like air and water, and one faction having control over water, and the other faction having control over power. In the middle of all of that, you've got like this sort of main kind of sort of hub market area, which is where the players will start. And that, it is quite good at sort of exemplifying a lot of the culture of the ring. It's interesting how it runs it, because how you run it, because the factions that are involved, it does give you their kind of sort of wants and their needs, but it is trying to hold you to a timeline, and quite a tight timeline at that. You're trying to explore essentially, I think it's four locations. You've got the dock, you've got the common area, and then you've got the two sections that the factions are holed up in, which are explored in sort of greater detail. And how you approach the issue is entirely up to you. Your players can be sort of peacemakers, your players can be brokers, your players can ally with one faction or the other and raid the other one. When I ran it, my players raided the faction that were controlling the water. I forget what they're called. Is it the Parliament, I think?
The Parliament, yep.
Essentially, they're led by and they're led by a crone called Monotone. Essentially, they did a spacewalk on the outside of the ring, cut their way into the server room, and took it over, was what my players ended up doing. They treated with Roy Mirror and the punks that were holed up in the engine room, and they decided to ally with them. They eventually decided to go for a raid, and it was a external spacewalk and then a bit of a firefight. Which is a shame, because what you find out if you speak with the two members of the factions is that they were actually, during the Gem War, I believe it actually fought side by side. And there's some of that relationship can come out in play, but yeah, my players sadly were itchy to get into some shenanigans with gunfights and spacewalks. So I did enjoy the social bits in the there's a bar called the Tsuru Tsuru, and that I thought was pretty good at sort of exemplifying. I used that and a lot of the random tables to just essentially get across a lot of the kind of culture and things like that. You know, there was someone with an AI, I think it was a robot monkey, had things like that on his shoulder. There's others that were touting, you know, non-phys experiences, which is this essentially how they refer to drug culture, that kind of stuff. So yeah, it worked really, really well. But I would say, the game doesn't have, it's very abstracted in terms of, say, timekeeping. for the whole scenario. It's about a timeline.
And a very tight one. So, throughout the rules, it mentions time everywhere. You know, how many weeks of travel, how many minutes you're affected by a particular ability. So this is a very time-focused game, and it doesn't provide the tools really to manage it at all anywhere, or to understand, you know, what the impact of something taking 4 weeks instead of 1 week is. And that kind of, you know, I kind of had to start mathing out a bit of things here, because there's two things that it's, there's the 4 hour timeline that it sets, but doesn't give you any travel times around the station for, but it also gives you this 500 holo debt that the crew of play, you know, the crew starts with. And it's very hard to figure out how effort is required to pay that debt off. And there's this contradiction at the start that, and probably the biggest thing missing from the rules is that at the start it says contracts give you clean holos. But if you look at the contracts rewards in the random tables at the end of the book, there is no holo rewards. So you kind of have to make up this whole payment scheme that is, you know, as far as I can tell, not in these rules, and extrapolate from the contractor rates to try and figure out how much the players might be given for various things throughout the system.
Sorry, my take on it as well was, I think the way that I settled on it was that I wanted to be clear on what kind of rate I wanted my players to be able to buy improvements to their hub and the like. And so what was more guiding me was the rate I wanted to sort of allow them to afford that kind of stuff, rather than trying to create out of whole cloth an economy of what contracts would be worth what. There is a little bit of an indicator in terms of what you can hire other like retainers to do. There's a little retainers kind of chart, which does give you some context, but I agree. It would have been nice to have a sliding scale, I think, of risk and contract type, just in examples of the various extremes of that, from, you know, sort of something that's a fairly sort of easy milk run kind of thing to something that is obviously going to be sort of insanely dangerous. It would have been nice to know what people would offer for that, and it doesn't really give you that. I agree.
Within the starting scenario, there's not the money within that scenario to pay off that Hollows debt. That's clearly set up as the motivating force for the players beyond the starting scenario, regardless of how it resolves, because it will resolve without them. They can totally fail the scenario and things will happen, and they will lose the context they've established. And the scenario effectively it doesn't literally blow up, but it's kind of intended to, if you fail things, then you kind of cross out half of what the setting is, and you keep going with a whole lot of dead bodies lying around. You know, again, it's not specific about how that happens, but it's kind of the implication there is that you've now got to fill out additional sections of the station with new, you know, and you've lost the ability to develop these relationships that you could have used to get your contracts. That hook of this debt is smart in that sense, but it's, and I guess there's a contract that says pay off a debt as an award. So you could literally take that contract and pay off that debt. And that's probably what's intended.
So the way that I ran the initial scenario, so just I went slightly off piste with it, was that my premise for the start of the game was that my players had a starship hub, and that the background before I kicked off the scenario, I said that they had accidentally, while docking, caused some damage, that they had docked badly, they damaged the dock, and they were being told that they could not leave port until they paid off the debt. And then there was the impending threat of the conflict, meant that they were motivated to both try and resolve the conflict and make the money to pay off the debt, so that they could actually leave if they wanted to. So that was my solve for it. But the fact that I had to make a solve is indicative that you there's a little bit of, for a scenario, which my, what I tend to ask of a written scenario is that I don't have to do any sort of heavy lifting. It was making me do a little bit of
lifting. But I think other than that, it's very clearly written. It's well laid out, and you can, again, as a way of, you know, it describes a situation which you can solve in a lot of different ways, which is ideal. Often a starting scenario just walks you through a series of rooms to a destination and you don't have much control over.
That's very much an OSR conceit as well, which is situations rather than plots. So it'll lay out a situation, it'll lay out the areas, the spaces and the people, but what it won't do is sort of have a stage of scenes, if you will, like you get in more sort of traditional games, which I actually appreciate. I also thought that it detailed the non-player characters well, so the various NPCs that you meet. They were all well motivated, they all had good quirks, they were all reasonably memorable. And even the factions have their own kind of IDs. It describes what they wear and how they comport themselves. Yep. So it's pretty good. So it all painted a nicely vivid picture for the players, which I thought was good.
And then the final third of the book is random tables, which fill out things like that really haven't been discussed elsewhere, like space creatures and various encounters and more locations around the Iron Ring. And is there anything you wanted to call out here?
I was going to say the creatures, I would say the Iron Ring locations and the drugs are probably things that, yeah, the space encounters, I think, was the other one as well that I probably wanted to highlight. But yeah, the creatures do kind of encapsulate what it's talking about when it talks about the sort of the strange tales from spaces who have encountered sort of things that exemplify the void. And there's some really some of them are quite revolting, some of the creatures. There's a snake that gets inside you and consumes you from within. And it says to get rid of the snake, snatch it when it is moving between body parts.
Which implies as well that when it moves between your arm and your chest, it's actually going out and back in again.
Yeah, or I think just under the skin or something. Revolting, I would imagine, yeah. I quite like the Roche spider, I thought was good, which was a spider made of constantly shifting colours. Abstract patterns on its back are said to show you worst nightmares of people looking at it.
Yeah, and again, with two words stuck together, there's a science word, there's a mundane word, they whack them together, and I think there's a few of those creatures have that kind of name. I think that works well.
Oort flies, yes, yeah. Aurora massworms, yeah. But it also has these legendary creatures as well, the Star Eater, the Super Hydra. It says, in forgotten corners of the Iron Ring, masked cultists worship the Super Hydra, a mythical serpent of the abyss with 1,000 maws, forever feeding on the phosphorescent vortex. Doesn't say what any of that is. It's just for you to take away and do something with it. It has lists of traps, which I thought was useful. I think that's something in sci-fi games that's quite often hard to conceptualize, is because you've got a technology element rather than your sort of traditional, I don't know, poison needle or explosive runes or whatever from a dungeon game. This is talking about sort of triggers like sort of chemical sniffers and heat detectors, and then the effects might be something like molten metal coming out of a refinery or something like that. You know, some crucible set to tip molten metal over you, or a Tesla spike shock you with electricity, or hardening foam sprayed over you. All sorts of interesting things like this, which were really good, because I would definitely, I appreciate a resource for tech traps when I'm running a game like this. The space encounters absolutely filled out all the setting really well, I thought. The sort of thick people that you could meet, be it merchants, miners, hijackers, you know, claim jumpers, all that kind of thing. Things that you might find in space, things that you might be able to scavenge. Brilliant. All of that's really helpful. And the Iron Ring locations I thought was really good, because essentially being able to just have players explore a sector and just generate it from tables is a really helpful thing. If you're needing to pad out, say, a journey between sections where you've done some detailing and you want to actually add a little bit of detail, these are great. And then addictive substances, some of them are very, very odd as to what they are. I quite like that a lot of the addictive substances aren't really intended to be addictive substances, but have been repurposed as such. So there's a cleaning oil, which allows you to stay awake for days if you ingest it. But that's not what it's for. It's for cleaning. So, there's, other drugs are sort of actual sort of medicines and things like that. But yeah, I quite liked, again, it's reinforcing themes, which is done all the way through the book. It's in reinforcing themes of repurposing and salvaging things and using them for other purposes. That's bang on theme for Death in Space, which is all about
that. I think you'll find they're called addictive substances rather than drugs. If they were called drugs, this book couldn't be sold in Australia because you aren't allowed to have positive depictions of drugs in your games in Australia. It means the game will be banned. So these are, just to be clear, we're talking about addictive substances.
Addictive substances, it doesn't mention them once. So you're absolutely right. And all your substances are called everything from pentamicetic milk to antisifrine to peas. Yep. Small green sleeping pills, I think.
This game doesn't feature random tables for generating planets. Kind of notable. That's, I think, a bit of a science fiction staple, and perhaps they just said, well, that's not what our focus is going to be. It's going to be the weird places outside of planets that are probably the most interest to this game. And I have to agree. Also, it has space encounters, but it doesn't really do a huge amount with there's no deck plans, for instance, on spacecraft. I don't think those are needed.
Yeah, it's very abstracted in that. I think because it uses the terms modules for all the different parts of spacecraft, a lot of those modules are very much almost coded as rooms. So you've got your I don't know, hydroponics lab, you've got your machine shop or whatever. You're almost, when you're generating these hubs, it's very much feeling like you're building almost a deck plan. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the record sheets.
No, I didn't see any in the game, and I should have probably checked to have downloaded those. I got another disadvantage of Australia is, of course, it's extremely expensive to get anything shipped here. So I think worth noting that for the most part, I'll be buying electronic editions and talking about them rather than physical product.
So it's worth going to the download section and having a look at. There's a hub record sheet that you can get.
Yeah. Just while you're looking for those, I'm going to point, there's no deck plans, but there is 2 pages of gun silhouettes. I'm not entirely convinced in the aliens being as much of an influence, I think, on the genre as Alien. We inevitably have to have our military porn.
So, I think there's a hub record sheet. I'm just trying to find it. But it does have like a sort of a grid on it for mapping out a deck plan. So I think the expectation is possibly that the players just sort of scribble on where their hubs are in relation to one another spatially. Do we want to talk about anything else in regards to Death in Space?
Yeah, I think you pretty much summarized at the start, unless you had any further thoughts to add. I thoroughly enjoyed it. As I said, I think there are 2, if not 3 things that are absolutely worth reading this book for. You touched on the initiative system, the void points system, and the origins, I think, are just outstanding pieces of design. The whole thing is extremely coherent in terms of its design aesthetic. The writing is all, I think, largely because everything except the 2 cults pages were largely the work of 1 or 2 authors. It's not trying to be generic. It's being extremely specific while leaving plenty of space for you to fill in and having a number of touch points. And I think not only the media that they've specifically referenced at the front of the book, but enough other ideas. And I can absolutely see this being something you could invest a lot of time and energy into and get a lot of rewarding play out of.
In terms of support for the system, it's been a while in development. And I'm not sure when it's going to make an appearance, but there is a further release for Death in Space plan called Dead Flag Contracts. That hope, from the description of it, it's meant to be a sort of a sandbox kind of sort of setting. But it looks like it's been sort of mired in development for quite a long time. There are some third party modules. Notably, I would probably recommend modules by an author called Christian Eichhorn, who has also made quite a lot for Cyborg and Merkborg. He's done a fully fledged, I think, sort of sandbox system to explore in depth in space as well. So we can probably put that in the show notes too.
Yeah. We've gone quite long for our first episode. And I think we've certainly rushed through this and a half or perhaps even two thirds of the book once we realized how much we'd spent up front. I feel like we've got some good material in here. I certainly have enjoyed spending the time talking through it with you.
Yeah, it's been great. And I would say, to be honest, if we're setting out a sort of a template for these, I think we're probably going to have to be aware of the fact that a system is chunkier than an adventure module, and it is going to require a fair amount of dissection. We might want to be a bit more regimented with how we spend our time, but
you're going to have to keep me reattached to the hull with a tether. I am going to tangent. I have a prepared set of subtopics I want to rhapsody about, a few of which we've touched on here, but there's plenty more to come.
So we had our meal. Are you happy that we've ended on a beach? Mm. I would say that the beach is in there. I wouldn't say it ended on that. I would say that the beach in Death in Space is the sort of strange kind of, if we were talking about sort of strange liminal spaces, I think there's definitely that sort of pervasive, the whole aspect of the sort of void and the sort of strangeness of that. And I think to a certain extent, the game does have a sense of this sort of subsistence and loneliness that definitely does strike a few of those notes of a sort of an odd kind of liminal space.
Yeah, it doesn't leave you with the mystery. It puts the mystery at the start. Yeah. It says this thing's happening at the start, and then it kind of touches on it at the end of the creatures section. There's some more kind of bigger white whale creatures that you might want to go after, but it doesn't really point players at those.
Yeah, there's little bits tucked away in some of the tables and some of the descriptions of the planets as well. There's little hints, but yeah, it's quite kind of upfront that there's this issue, and then it just has it as a sort of an undercurrent with the occasional little spotlights on it, but very little in, like, really in your face about it for the rest of the book. It's, as you say, it's all up the front.
And it doesn't propose the players are going to provide a solution, which I think is the point of the book, is that things are failing inevitably, and what you are doing is swimming against the current, sucking you into the center.
I suppose as a final point, I should point out that there is actually a table in there of how you die in space. If you look at the death section at the end of combat, if you die, you get a sense as you are dying that reality isn't right and that your life should not have turned out this way, and you get a vision of how you should have died. And there's a table for it, which is a really bizarre conceit. And that's probably, again, one of the areas is if your character dies is where you end up on that liminal beach, which is probably quite apt for Death in Space.
More than happy to end there. We certainly enjoyed this discussion. If you have any questions, you'll be able to comment on the blog post that we'll be putting up along with this episode. I don't know if we're going to open the Discord to the public. We might have a chat about that afterwards and just see if we wanted people to jump in there as well. And there's a list of things that we're going to be talking through, but we are more than happy to take suggestions for what we should be talking about. Thank you again.
Thanks very much, folks. This is Dougal signing off, and all systems are nominal.
Ignition sequence has started. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. We have commit.